So, Mr. Harris, could you introduce the next item?
Item number 11 is the Municipal Stormwater Program Direction and Proposed LID Expenditure. Dominic Rock will be making the presentation. This is an information item about a project the Board's Municipal Stormwater Program has undertaken to assist municipalities in evaluating the effectiveness of their urban runoff management efforts. Dominic will also describe how the project can help municipalities better prepare for a future in which stormwater is managed as much as a resource as it is a problem.
Thank you, Mr. Harris. Good morning, Chairman Wolf and members of the board. I'm Dominic Rock, supervisor of the Stormwater Unit at Region 3. And I'll be presenting you an item. After focusing efforts on low-impact development and post-construction requirements in recent years, some long board meetings that you might recall, our municipal stormwater program is adjusting its direction to a watershed-based approach to program implementation. This is not a massive major shift. It is a reflection of the times and of the emphasis that a lot of programs around the state are undertaking. So I'll explain why this is needed, and I'll talk about the project that we've developed to support it. So this shift in direction is intended to help bring about a future for urban stormwater management, one where permittees are managing urban runoff on a catchment scale or a small watershed scale to protect and restore watershed processes while also accruing some added benefits of climate resilience and water supply security. So with this end in mind, we should probably rewind briefly to see how stormwater management has changed over the years. Essentially, the imperative for flood management, flood control, was what led us into this entire realm of managing stormwater. And, of course, the imperative there was to protect public health and property and remove people and property out of harm's way. And so a considerable amount of expenditure was placed on what we would consider today gray infrastructure to convey stormwater out of urban areas. But it wasn't long before we recognized that there were some environmental impacts to just routing water quickly out of cities, and we found there was damage in receiving waters and streams, and you've probably all seen examples of massive erosion and stream failure and bridge abutments being taken out, that kind of thing. So there was a real need to recognize that peak flow had to be managed. And so the era of managing peak flow was introduced with detention basins, which you see a small example there on the left. There's an umbrella upside down in that detention basin. But those represented surface detention facilities that also provided some opportunity to settle out some of the suspended solids in stormwater. So you were capturing a little bit of the pollutant loading as well. And then on the right, there's an example of a subgrade catchment system as well, or a detention facility. So while these were fairly effective in addressing the major impacts of our previous effort to quickly convey stormwater out of urban environments, it addressed to some degree the water quality impact because of the ability to capture some of the sediment. But after a while, we began to recognize that this as well was not really satisfactory in terms of water quality. There were continued impacts on stream environments where even the small rate of discharge from these detention facilities could lead to an unraveling of a stream system. If those flows were maintained over a long duration at a certain level, they could do almost as much damage as a large event. And so the era of managing flow duration came into effect. And the question of really addressing the whole volume, the total volume of stormwater, became principal. And so when we started to reflect on how do we control volume and reduce the volume of discharge from our urban environments, it became obvious that we needed to really just start looking at how the natural system works and try to replicate that to the extent we can. So we began the more recent era of stormwater management, which was to mimic natural hydrologic functions, which is what low-impact development does. and it's what our post-construction requirements do as well. They really focus on managing the volume coming off of the urban environment. Each one of these shifts from protection of health and property, public health and property, to peak flow management with a water quality component, to the more aggressive approach to mimicking hydrologic approaches, has represented a shift in stormwater management. And all of these have occurred really in the last couple of decades. So what we are confronted with now is perhaps another shift to address some of these other issues like climate change and water supply. But we have put a great deal of effort into post-construction requirements to manage the volume of runoff from new and redevelopment in our region. And we're now implementing those requirements, which were developed or which were approved by you back in September of 2012, I think. Again, those requirements addressed on-site management of runoff. So as development occurs or redevelopment occurs, the developer is expected to manage their runoff by treating it, retaining some portion of it, and also continuing to manage the peak. So while these requirements are very effective, they're only effective in places where growth or redevelopment is occurring. So there's a significant amount of the urban existing landscape which is not going to be addressed by this very appropriate approach to development. So we're actually managing stormwater in those existing urban areas with the same gray infrastructure that's been there all along, that's also beginning to fall apart, if you have been paying attention. Considerable backlog of infrastructure needs and rehabilitation. But we're still managing them with the standard programmatic approaches that our stormwater programs have been using for several years, since the beginning, really. Minimum control measures, which include public outreach and education to keep people from pouring storm or motor oil into a storm drain or encourage them to pick up after their girls, their dogs. Illicit discharge detection and elimination programs. Municipal housekeeping, wherein the cities, like the city of Watsonville itself, sweeps its streets, manages its facilities, reduces its load of pollutants, and reduces its contribution to urban runoff. And then construction site management, which is aided by a completely different permit for general construction activities and stormwater discharges. And then the post-construction requirements that are up on the screen here. So these efforts, however, might be effective, particularly with the post-construction requirements in these new and redeveloped areas, but the existing urban footprint is not really improving that quickly over time. And there's a need to understand how to make those minimum control measures more effective and provide the MS4s or the permittees with tools to evaluate their effectiveness. There we go. So in addition to that context, a drought is upon us. And in a region with really quite limited rainfall in the first place, and with a near total reliance on groundwater and the need to recharge it through rainfall, the practice of letting stormwater run off of our urban landscapes into receiving waters is not only a water quality issue, it's of course a water supply issue. So I'll talk a little bit about the water board's responses, but the state and regional board's responses over time to the evolving stormwater context. And we have three principal mechanisms or tools available to us. We have permits, we have plans and policies, and we have grant funding programs. With respect to the permits, we of course do have industrial discharge and construction water ground stormwater discharge permits. But within the municipal context, we have these two principal types of permits, the Phase 1 permits, and, of course, the city of Salinas is our only Phase 1 municipality in the Central Coast. And then we have over 30 Phase 2 municipal permits. And those, of course, they codify this approach to using a set of minimum control measures. And they encourage the municipalities to evaluate the effectiveness of those measures in reducing stormwater pollutants to the maximum extent practicable. They include treatment requirements. They're quantitative now, universally throughout all of the permits in the state. And now the requirement for post-construction requirements, which include a retention requirement in most cases, and low impact development at a minimum, is now built into all of our permits. Now, the plans and policies of the state have also been emerging in part to recognize and address the issue of water supply. And so we have the recycled water policy, which has an actual stormwater goal to increase the use of stormwater over that in 2007 by at least 500,000 acre feet per year by the year 2020, and by at least 1 million acre feet per year by the year 2030. So the recycled water policy itself has a clear imperative for stormwater capture and use. The strategic plan of the state water boards, as well as the emerging groundwater program, also reflect important plans and policies that recognize water, stormwater as a resource. And then finally, our grant funding programs, even all the way back to Prop 50, have reflected this awareness that capturing stormwater and improving stormwater quality are actually similar and sometimes complementary goals. With the most recent proposition, Prop 1, there's now an emerging requirement to develop stormwater resource plans. So as a prerequisite for actually receiving any proposition funding for stormwater or state funding for stormwater projects, you have to develop stormwater resource plans, which is going to change how the permittees organize their thinking around stormwater management. So I think with all of this emerging approach that the state boards have and regional boards have developed, there's a clear message, which is that stormwater is a resource best managed through watershed approaches. And while water quality does remain the unambiguous goal, and it's embedded in the MPDS stormwater permits, recognizing and using how stormwater and using stormwater as a resource is going to change how we achieve that goal. Now, I want to introduce and remind you that watersheds are scalable and nested systems, because it reminds you that there's a spatial element to managing stormwater. And this is very critical. In effect, we have asked the permittees to go out and manage a resource that flows across the landscape according to hydrologic rules. Sometimes those are manipulated by the conveyances that they construct. But ultimately, watersheds and natural hydrologic function are what are governing the flow of watersheds. And understanding how that occurs on a spatial scale is critical to managing it. Of course, you can talk about watersheds on a pretty large scale, like the picture on the left shows the 418 larger watershed system or watersheds in our region. You can break it down into the 15,000 watersheds in the picture on the right. But if you keep drilling down to this example of, somewhere the San Lorenzo River is in here, and you know that this whole area is populated with urban settlements, you can see that's the kind of scale where we really need to start thinking in terms of municipal stormwater management. And if we break that down even further, taking Watsonville as an example, here's where you're located in the red star. These are the catchments that are really the appropriate scale for managing stormwater, both in terms of its resource value and capturing potential capture opportunities and use, but also in managing the pollutant loading associated with urban runoff. Each of these polygons, these black outlined polygons, represents a delineation of the city of Watsonville into urban catchments, which are at an approximately 100-acre scale here. Some of them are larger, some of them a little bit smaller, but that's a roughly 100-acre scale that is really the appropriate scale at which to develop and start thinking about stormwater loading, load reduction, and stormwater as a resource. Another example is the city of Paso Robles. So you see the urbanized portion of the landscape there. That's the city itself. And then there's two large polygons, which represent sort of the scale at which these urban catchments would be delineated for the city of Paso. So this brings us to the project that we've been working on. We believe there's really no better approach to helping the municipal stormwater permittees respond to the message that stormwater is a resource best managed through watershed approaches than to assist them with this shift toward a watershed-based approach to program implementation and assessment. The work that we're doing here builds from work that was completed in the Tahoe region. And we saw that work, as well as our own work from the Central Coast, showcased at a meeting in Oakland yesterday of stormwater managers, state and federal regulators, and permittees, municipalities, which talked a lot about all these different approaches to assessing the effectiveness of the programs, building on a watershed-based approach to managing stormwater. Very encouraging approach, and the work at Tahoe was highlighted. And that's what we're doing here. We're kind of taking that to the next step. What it involves is three basic elements. The urban catchment mapping, which you saw the example of Watsonville broken into the catchments. All of our municipalities need to undertake that effort to build the foundation for the spatial understanding of how their water and stormwater can be best managed. Second, it includes a pollutant loading and pollutant load reduction estimation tool, which is required by the Phase 2 permit. Municipalities need to move from sort of an open-ended, iterative approach to implementing these minimum control measures to a longer-term analytical framework, which has a spatial component and a quantitative component. We need to start understanding how the work that they're doing, the money that they're spending in all of their programs, is actually manifested in improvements in water quality. And we could do that by looking at load reduction over time through at each catchment. And then finally, the third component of this is to look at their best management practices, their BMPs, to track those, how they're being performed, track their maintenance, and evaluate the contribution they're making to load reduction. The schematic that's being used to describe the project we're doing, we call it the MS4 support project, includes these different tools, but the basic process is to complete your detailed mapping of the catchments, conduct some inventory, and of course this can happen over time, it doesn't have to happen overnight, but ultimately get a complete inventory of your best management practices and some assessment of their performance through a tool called BMP-RAM, or Best Management Practice Rapid Assessment Method. And then the third phase is to run those models, the tool for estimating load reduction, to determine how much reduction load you're getting from the use of those BMPs. Then take a look at where you need to improve or prioritize further implementation of your BMPs, and then continue kind of with this cycle. So it, again, is an iterative process, but it's based on quantitative and spatial information. Again, you'd have the ability to develop maps like this, which show a prioritization. This is an example. I don't want to suggest this is the city's final prioritization of catchments, but it's an example of how a very simple color-coded approach can be used to demonstrate for a stormwater manager, for a city council member, for the public to understand where stormwater management needs to be focused, and where perhaps we could take a lighter approach and start to focus the appropriate focus the limited resources that the municipalities have on a smaller portion of their landscape. So this chart just shows you an example of, say, today's is the year 2015, and we have an estimate of the discharge of pollution and of volume, discharge volume, from a particular catchment. When we don't have any BMPs modeled into it. So we're just taking kind of a baseline example. We add the BMPs into the model, and we see that we're getting less discharge when we put the BMPs in, because some of them are capturing runoff volume and some of them are capturing pollutants as well. So we know that we have a reduction of that amount, a catchment. You could also aggregate this to a city level as well. But you can do that over time, and you start to see if you're doing things right, you know, because you're seeing a reduction in loading. Another expression of this is a fancier slide that I borrowed from our consultants, which just shows you that over time, you real clearly can see the decrease in load. This represents a five-year time frame, very optimistic, I would say, for as an example. But you get a decrease in load and an increasing benefit. So we think that an urban catchment-based approach to program assessment and program implementation is the foundation for better understanding of BMP effectiveness. It will actually set us up to do more targeted and appropriate and resource-efficient monitoring of outfalls and potentially of some receiving waters. And ultimately, it provides the permittees with a better opportunity to demonstrate their compliance with the permit and accountability to their ratepayers and taxpayers and their citizens. So now I want to tell you that the Low Impact Development Fund will be the source of funding for this project. Just to kind of go back in time and remind you that the LID fund was established back in 2008. It was first brought to you as a conceptual proposal in 2007, actually. But in 2008, you approved the establishment of an endowment, included $2 million in an endowment and $250,000 in an operating fund. And essentially, there's an agreement which dictates how that money can be spent, what kinds of projects it can be spent on. And so staff has been working on that ever since, and we've allocated over $2.2 million of the fund already to contractors. The principal contractor has been a contract to have the Central Coast LID Initiative performing a lot of this technical assistance to the municipalities, and that's been funded. Those funds have been directed to the UC Davis program and Dr. Darla Inglis, who's the director of the LID Initiative. But that allocation of $2.2 million also includes a more recent allocation of $220,000 in November of last year for Second Nature LLC. It's a consulting firm out of Santa Cruz that did the Tahoe work, and which we have hired to help us complete this work. So we've already completed phase one of the project, and we're prepared to move forward. We're very satisfied with the technical foundations of the project. It builds off of an incredible amount of work at Tahoe. And in fact, at yesterday's meeting, which I referred to, which was kind of a statewide meeting about approaches like this, there was a real call to take advantage of the considerable federal and state investment in the work done at Tahoe and try to move forward with that kind of analysis. So we're really happy to be leading the charge there and have the LID fund at our disposal to do that. We have a technically sound project that we're prepared to move forward with. I think more critically, we have the engagement of the stakeholders in our region. More than almost half of them are fully committed to working with this set of tools that are being developed for program assessment and effectiveness evaluation. The process or the project at this point for phase two is to refine and finalize the tool for estimating load reduction, which we call Teller, and also to develop the fine details of the rapid assessment method, which is substantially done but needs to be tailored somewhat for our region. And then we also are going to support the consultant in making these two components talk to each other so that when that iterative cycle of kind of returning back to your model, implementing BMPs, evaluating their effectiveness, that a municipal staff person can actually operate that kind of tool and get the feedback they need. We also need to fund the development of user guidance and training for the municipalities. And then finally, it's not entirely free for the municipalities to to comply with the Phase 2 permit. There's considerable cost in all of the minimum control measures that they're doing, but there's also going to be a cost incurred for evaluating the effectiveness of the program. And they've been doing this ever since 2003 when this permit hit the ground. They've been evaluating their programs. But again, it's been sort of an open-ended iterative process that lacked a good spatial and quantitative basis. And I think they, as well as the Water Board, will really appreciate the ability to kind of move this toward a longer-term, analytically based approach. So they will bear some of the cost at some point. We don't have exact estimates on that, but at this point they seem quite reasonable. And, of course, that's because we were able to pay for the development of the tool without their funds. So, in summary, this stormwater program shift and the MS4 support project that I've described will assist the water boards with regulatory oversight of the permittees, which is a key goal of ours. It will also inform our own future development of permits and for permit revisions. So the Salinas permit will be renewed in 2017, and we'll take some of this work, and it'll be built into the new permit. And then when the Phase 2 permit's redesigned by the State Board staff in 2018, I think we'll have a lot to say as well. But we think that the work is going to point the stormwater program toward that future where the permittees are managing urban stormwater and urban runoff on a catchment scale to protect and restore watershed process while also accruing added benefits of climate resilience and water supply security. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much for that presentation, and I appreciated how this tool might help us at least demonstrate visually what some of the high priority areas are in a community or a municipality. I'm wondering, with that high priority, how are those identified? And I mean high priority as an area to focus some of our resources. But then also, I guess that's the first question. How are those high priority areas identified? And then the second question has to do when this tool, its primary use is with new or redevelopment. And I'm wondering how this tool might still be used when we already have a built environment. I know you provided the city of Watsonville, but I imagine that many of these high priority areas, they're also areas where there isn't necessarily space to develop any further.
Right. Actually, I'd love to tackle that second question first. I think that the shift that I'm referring to in the overall presentation here is the shift from exclusive, you know, preoccupation, I should say, with post-construction requirements for new and redevelopment, which we know is going to be effective in the new and redevelopment context. Shifting from that, which is kind of taken care of on some level, back to the existing environment where there isn't going to be a lot of redevelopment. And the benefits of those new regulations won't be appreciated or won't be felt and won't have an impact on water quality. In a catchment that has no redevelopment over the next 10 or 15, 20 years, there will be no implementation of post-construction requirements. There will be no impact of those requirements. So what are we going to do in that environment? That's exactly what we're trying to determine using these tools. So that gets back to your first question, how do you prioritize them? The first prioritization metric is the volume of discharge that comes off of a catchment. So just taking two catchments if I can get all the way back quickly, here we go. Say you take this catchment here, and I know you can't see the screen, I'm sorry, but it's...
We have it up here.
But can you see my... you can't see my thing. So this is useless. Everyone else appreciates it, but you don't. just an example, you know, you take one of those upper watershed catchments, the top one, I think it says 16 or something. Let's say that when rainfall hits that catchment, for whatever reason, maybe because there's not that much imperviousness or because there's existing depressional storage available in that catchment, not that much runoff actually leaves the catchment. So you have a modest amount of runoff actually discharged under a rain event of some particular rain event. But then you go down to the next Watsonville 5, Watt 5 catchment. And for a different set of characteristics, lots of imperviousness, maybe higher gradient, who knows. That particular catchment generates a ton of runoff. And so right off the bat, you have a perfect prioritization tool. The place where you're going to get the greatest bang for your buck in terms of reducing loading of pollutants is the place that generates the most runoff. So that's a key metric, the volume of runoff. So it figures into the prioritization. The second thing that figures into the prioritization is the land use in those catchments. So are they intensive industrial land uses? Are they commercial? Are they single-family residential? Are they multifamily residential? All of those land uses have different pollutant profiles associated with them. So when you rain on a catchment, the land use will dictate what kinds of urban pollutants are coming off of it. So you combine the volume and knowledge about the landscape, the land uses, and the pollutants associated with them, and you can do a lot of fancy modeling around this. But on a very simple basis, you can model the total suspended solid as a pollutant, and you can begin to prioritize that way. The other component of the prioritization is how closely is a catchment linked to a receiving water? Does it dump right into Corralitos Creek? Does it dump right into Pajaro River? Is that impact on the receiving water immediate and intense? Or is it actually being mediated by its conveyance and traveling through the city, being caught by catch basins, being caught in detention basins? By the time it gets to the receiving water, has the load substantially been reduced already? So you can model that based on your hydrology, your land use, and basically those two components, and then a lot of assumptions and a lot of relationships that have been established by gobs and gobs of data collection in urban environments for many, many years.
Thanks, Dominic. One thing you mentioned early on in your presentation was oil dumping, and I thought that the mechanism to address that you referred to was outreach. And in urban environments, downtown Marina, lots of apartments, Salinas, lots of apartments, fairly mobile population sometimes, hard to get the word out, even if you go door to door and leave a flyer, or even if you talk to one person in the household, it's not really a great way of getting the message to everyone in the household. So outreach seems to be very difficult where you have more intensive, let's say, neighborhoods or residential. So how has the gobs of research concluded outreach is successful or not for things like oil, for initiatives like oil dumping reduction?
I think the data and the results of many years of public outreach and education efforts of a whole wide variety is mixed. More contemporary approaches use community-based social marketing, and that jargony term itself suggests that we need to target our public education and outreach efforts. You don't just put it on the side of the bus anymore. You don't have just radio spots. You've got to really somehow reach a person's psyche, and that's what the community-based social marketing concept is about. But in general, the programmatic approaches, including public outreach and education, public involvement, those are not considered to have a substantial impact in the big scheme of things. When large cities like Los Angeles or the Bay Area pay millions of dollars to have stormwater modeling done, they have an assumption they make, which is that those kinds of programs result in about 3-5% of the load reduction, period. They don't even bother with trying to tease it out because it's not that substantial of a contribution. On the other hand, Can you imagine if we didn't have those programs? If we hadn't marked the storm drains with the decals that say drains to the creek, and if we hadn't raised awareness about dumping oil down storm drains, you know, it might actually be a more significant part of the load still. So it could be that the greatest benefit of those programs has been achieved. They're definitely not being viewed throughout the federal and state stormwater world as the go-to management measure anymore.
All right, thank you.
Well, I like the approach. I mean, I can really see how if I'm the city of Salinas, I could, you know, and I had tools that would show me if instead of sweeping every street in the city every other month, I could concentrate my street sweeping resources on these 30 streets and do it minimally elsewhere, I could spend the same amount of money on street sweeping and have a much greater pollutant reduction. I like that. I guess I have a couple of – well, first one comment. We've been known occasionally to come up with nifty ideas that look great from this side of the podium and not so great to the regulated community. So, and I see representation out here from Watsonville, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Santa Cruz County. And I would hope that we hear some public comment on this, you know, in terms of how folks are looking at it, just to get a sense. The second thing is I'm just curious, you're talking about a shifting in the in where we're spending the money that we set aside to fund the low impact development initiative, sort of where that's at over what period of time we see spending that down, just to have a sense.
Yes, I don't know if anyone submitted speaker cards, but I guess now would be the time to do that.
We have one.
Okay. Yeah. Regarding the LID fund expenditure, as I said, it's been in place since 2008, the fund has. There was an immediate downturn in the stock market after setting up the endowment, as it was termed. And it was apparent that we would not be able to realize the original objective, which was to have an endowment that generated earnings over time and potentially leveraged additional resources so that the endowment would remain and we'd just spend interest and earnings. That became clear immediately. The timing was wrong for that. So we actually came back to the board in 2009 and requested that the endowment concept essentially be dissolved and to recognize this as a fund that would be spent over time. And we did not propose an end date or a particular sunset of the expenditure. We felt like an adaptive approach, recognizing, responding to the needs of the permittees and the overall success of our efforts with implementing low impact development, that following that and tracking that over time would be better than committing to any particular time frame for expending that. We then had great success with the initial technical assistance, and I think Darla Inglis has brought to you at least three annual reports, and of course there's an annual report embedded in the link in your staff report for this last year of what the LID initiative has been doing. Very successful. We've been working in a number of areas that have slowly moved from sort of specific technical assistance to a little bit broader programmatic approach, which is very much consistent with this more recent effort of looking at the whole city, evaluating the catchments and their potential for improvements through low-impact development and through a spatial and quantitative approach. So one of the key things that happened Along the way, of course, was the adoption of requirements that people do post-construction requirements or post-construction stormwater management, and that they do LID. So the impetus to provide technical assistance while there has been somewhat mediated by the fact that people have to do it now, and they're going to figure out how to do it. And so it's not just the Water Board's technical assistance providing the way. You know, there's a self-interest now in learning how to do LID. At the October meeting of the California Association of Stormwater Quality Agencies, we're going to have the opportunity to have a half-a-day workshop on the Central Coast post-construction implementation. And it's, I think there's over 120 people signed up to attend it. So it's a very, very much of a interest of a topic of interest to everyone still, but we are seeing success in our implementation of post-construction requirements. And so that has definitely allowed us to consider a different funding strategy or a different set of opportunities to fund through the LID fund. And so currently, the work that we're doing with Second Nature represents a substantial investment of that fund, and it will spend it down to about half of what it is or what it started at. So we'll still have money once we've paid for this project, but not as much, and we do anticipate that it would be a matter of, you know, 5 years that we could anticipate sort of spending that over time at a reasonable level that would sustain the effort and provide the assistance that we need. I don't know if that's kind of a long-winded explanation, but it's definitely been an adaptive management style. We've had the great benefit and privilege of spending that money on things that we thought were appropriate. We've had the buy-in from the community for the most part. You've supported us, and I anticipate that we'll be doing this for several more years. It's not, the money's not that short. We still have about, I think at last count, I have a dollar amount here. At the end of August, the endowment or the fund had $1.15 million in it. No, take that back. It had 1.1 in the main fund and 20,000 in the in the operating fund. So the total is about $1.2 million, which is different from what was in staff report, because staff report came out a month earlier. So it's always changing based on the stock market value of the portfolio.
Okay, Monica.
Thank you, Dominic. And I'm really pleased to see the shift to a different aspect of this long-term set of goals that we have is really important. I mean, you know, starting out with some of the more obvious kind of low-hanging fruit aspects of how the program implementation was structured and areas that need a specific prioritization and so forth. So, but I'm always pleased to see that it's set up and designed in a way that it becomes integral, and then we use our resources to continue that leading edge. So I appreciate the work that goes into that and that strategic thinking, if you will, of our time and resources and expertise. I'm just curious. I see Dr. Inglis is here in the room, and I'm not sure if she's a speaker or if I can ask her to come to the podium and share any additional insight she has. I know she's been leading the community collaboration, if you will, of the MS4s, and she probably has some insights that we can understand how this, you know, this became like the next logical step in an evolution of a program that's grown and has, I think, become a very substantial part of the work of the regional board throughout the region, which a lot of our programs don't achieve that kind of broader breadth. We see, you know, targeted areas where particular land use or particular problem areas that, you know, drive kind of our engagement with those communities. But this is a place where we actually are more generically involved, if you will. So do you want to come up and talk to us?
Could we do it this way, if you don't
sure.
mind?
Mm-hmm.
We have speaker cards, and I'd like to then include it when we'll have speakers come and at the same time. That way, I think it puts it into the proper context, because I have myself a couple of questions first.
Oh, that's fine. I just would like to be sure that we hear
yeah,
from Dr.
Yeah, we will do
Ellis.
That, but, you know, yeah. we have speaker cards, and, you know, you won't need a speaker card. We'll have you come after we have three other speakers. That way it gives us a chance to get, you know, more information, augmentation. Do you have any other question at this time?
Mr. Chair, I want to make sure that we also recognize, I think the city of Salinas is here. Is that correct? And they have a short...
For this next
That's
item.
For item
oh,
12.
For the next item, right. Okay,
yeah.
Thank you.
But I do have three speaker cards. So my two questions. My first one is, you know, if I figure the math right, you plan on spending about half of the remaining funds on this project. Is that?
Close to that. It's less than half.
But okay. Yeah. 40%, 45%. I'm thinking return on investment. You know, this is being presented to us. However, how much effort was it made to look at other potential LID project spending that could be used? Because I'm sort of in the dark. You know, this is okay. This is what we want to do, but in the return on investment is the research and the view that this is well justifiable to appropriate close to 50% of the total remaining funds available?
Oh, you know, without a doubt. I can't stress to you how big of a difference it is to move from this kind of open-ended iterative approach to trying to figure out if our the permittees are having an effect on stormwater. It's been very frustrating for many years to look at effectiveness assessment reports and the annual reporting from the municipalities. It's been frustrating for them. They don't have a lot of metrics. They continue to have to spend money. The permit says you got to do all this stuff, and it has to work. And they're left without a lot of really good metrics. And so, from the one standpoint, is that this should solve that problem over time. Secondly, moving toward that spatial and quantitative approach is going to help them pinpoint their expenditures. This is going to save them money over time and increase their effectiveness. I'm absolutely confident of that. And we're not alone. We're seeing this approach replicated throughout the state through both the stormwater resources planning imperative or requirement and for the requirement to develop reasonable assurance analyses for implementation of the bigger phase one permits in LA and the regional board and San Francisco region. And then, you know, the key is this is foundational work. It's changing how permittees and regulators are approaching the challenge of urban stormwater management. And it is coming at a time when we can also add benefits and achieve ultimately multiple benefits of our work in stormwater, both in terms of climate resilience and climate change resilience and water supply security. So I don't have any doubt that this money will be well spent. Compare it to a physical infrastructure expenditure, so to support the city of Santa Barbara with putting permeable pavers on streets, or to support the city of Paso Robles with a green streets project. Those were really important for demonstration purposes, but is not what we want to spend our money on from the LID fund. For one thing, most of that can be done now through redevelopment and because it's required. And secondly, those projects are one-off, have the benefit on one particular catchment, and there's no way with the money we have that we can have any impact on the region, whereas this kind of work sets up a future where we really are managing on a catchment scale and achieving those multiple benefits.
Okay. All right. Thank you. So I appreciate that, you know, additional perspective. The other question that I have, it's not an issue in terms of, you know, the project itself, but the implementation of, you know, the project, meaning identifying locations for catchment basins, et cetera. And I guess where I'm coming from is making sure that there is good coordination with other works being done, because there's a lot of grant money that is spent right now in percolation studies. You know, for example, the Coastal San Luis RCD has got funding to perform a data gap study on the best percolation areas in the basin, in which basically is taking stormwater. And then it includes also percolation studies in blue line streams in terms of potential in-stream flow augmentations. Big picture, all this gets into ultimately sustainable groundwater management program in trying to catch the water and bring it back into the aquifer. So I guess one area of it's not a concern, since it hasn't started yet, but I think there is going to be, it's going to be very important to dovetail this together, so we don't end up with, you know, grant money spent in doing one thing, and then there is, you know, through the LID program, say, well, you know, these are the other points. So I think they're synergistic. And some of these percolation studies that I talk about are being done right now. And in fact, some of them, within the San Luis Obispo County, because this was a countywide project, I think the report is like 95% complete. So what would be good, too, is to, you know, for the LID, is to review those and then see how there can be some, you know, better synergies used there. Of course, one is more in the, not in city-centric, but more in the surrounding area, more in the urban areas, but nevertheless, you know, that it's all part of the same big picture.
Yeah, I agree. The Ecology Action up here in Santa Cruz County as well has done an infiltration analysis of LID opportunities, and the Central Coast Low Impact Development Initiative was a partner in that project. So we already are on the same page in that mm-hmm. regard. The tools that we're developing are going to be the foundation for those conversations, though. I mean, trying to have those conversations about opportunities within a spatial context is very difficult without mapping your catchments. So this is the first step to supporting that kind of discussion and making it productive. But I think it's important. We can't lose sight of the fact that we are implementing an NPDES program to address pollutant loading. And so the key objective for water board staff is to provide tools for the permittees and that they can use to then show us that they're accomplishing that. So that's a primary, unambiguous objective, and it's water quality. But as I said, it's the tool provides the foundation for all these additional efforts around water supply as well.
Yeah, and I know you use the term unambiguous, but I think, you know, this last drought shows that it's also unambiguous to make sure that we, you know, use every drop of water and try to put it to beneficial use.
So. Yeah, maybe the thing to remember about the recent work we did with post-construction requirements and really that third phase of mimicking hydrologic processes in stormwater management is to realize that volume management is the new standard. We aren't just treating and releasing or controlling peaks. We're trying to reduce the volume, because with volume reduction, you get pollutant reduction. And with volume reduction, you can do something else with that volume, and that's the piece you're talking about. So mm-hmm. they really are part of the same objective, and I don't think there's any way that we could separate the discussions at this point.
Correct.
They're very much integrated.
They're not mutually exclusive. All right. Well, I thank you very much for your clarification. And Mr. Young has a question also.
Thank you. A couple of questions for you, Dominic. Pretty certain you said that about half of our stakeholders are on board with this. Tell me about the other half.
Okay. The project initiated when Water Board staff made an effort to distill the components of the Phase 2 permit around effectiveness assessment. And the Phase 2 permit has some very explicit language about quantifying load reductions of your program and of individual BMPs, and it clearly accomplished the shift toward a quantitative approach. And when we started that discussion with the municipalities, there was a bit of a, as there always is, discomfort and an alarm at the notion of suddenly having to be accountable for the amount of metals or copper that's leaving their urban environment, because it suggests a water quality, receiving water limit kind of approach to permitting. And we had to say, well, let's slow down. Let's not get ahead of ourselves. In this permit term, you're not required to, you know, achieve any particular receiving water limit. And so what we really need to do is develop a set of tools that's going to help us understand the effectiveness of our programs. And so we started working with folks in the Monterey area, which has a natural kind of it's a natural kind of affiliation of communities up here, which is distinct from the group in the southern part of the region in Santa Barbara County and San Luis Obispo County. And we had a couple of false starts maybe here with kind of getting a little bit ahead of ourselves, focusing on monitoring efforts. And then we recognized there's an opportunity to kind of step back and look at this kind of load estimation on a catchment scale. And things started falling into place in this area. In San Luis Obispo and Santa Barbara County, the communities were kind of mixed. We have some communities in SLO County, including the county itself, which are participating in this effort. But in Santa Barbara County, they chose to move forward with a different, somewhat more conventional load reduction strategy or estimation strategy, using a consultant that does a lot of work in the larger municipalities. So they're just using a different set of objectives, or not objectives, different set of tools, but I think they're still moving forward in the same fashion around a spatially oriented estimating load reduction, developing a tool that municipalities will have at their disposal to look at the impact of their program improvements over time.
Okay, so I think I misunderstood you then, because I thought maybe you were saying that half of our stakeholders had some kind of opposition to this approach, and you're saying no, it's just half of them are on board with using this tool.
Yeah, there's no imperative that they use this tool.
I suppose. Okay.
However, the ones that are using this tool are getting this benefit of a tool that's being developed specifically for them with funds from the Water Board. Whereas in Santa Barbara, they don't have the same public funding support, so they're trying to develop this with their own resources. And of course, they've collectivized and they've banded together around the county, the communities around the county, and they're paying for that on their own. I have a description of their effort if you'd like to hear that, but it's it says the model will produce a catchment prioritization, which is very similar to ours, the region up here. That reflects jurisdiction-specific priority, water body pollutant combinations, weighted based on the local agency's relative priorities. This approach uses this particular consultant's published BMP planning methodology, which is well well respected throughout the country. It's GIS based, and it basically relies on a strategic BMP prioritization approach. So the tools are somewhat similar. There are going to always be competing approaches in terms of modeling estimates or load reduction or loading in general. And at much of this workshop I've mentioned a couple of times now that we attended yesterday in Oakland was an opportunity to see the principal approaches that are being used throughout the state to evaluate loading and load reduction. And the difference really is that some of the models use a longer-term, analytically more, hard to describe it as any more accurate because it's not, but it uses a lot more data to crunch to get really what are basically the same outputs, which is you need to do more over here than over there. What we found in this region was that trying to import that into the context of these smaller communities would be very expensive, for one thing, and wouldn't necessarily give them the tool that they could use internally and on their own to manage their programs. I think in the Santa Barbara example, there will be a point at which the judgment day will happen when the permittees down there are trying to take advantage of this tool that's being developed, and it's not entirely clear to me how the handoff is going to be to the local jurisdictions. So that's something we're going to be tracking. And in terms of the two parts of our region demonstrating compliance with the quantitative or with the effectiveness assessment requirements of the permit, we don't have any way of regulating that they do one thing or the other. We have to, you know, give them the opportunity to pursue these two courses. And the benefit of that is we'll have an opportunity to compare.
The Lake Tahoe example, how long has that been in effect, and has it demonstrated any tangible improvements to water quality?
We actually have the author of the project proponent of that effort, Nicole Beck. Dr. Beck is in the audience, and she's actually leading the technical work on this effort as well. So she might be able to speak to that and comment, but I know that effort's been at least a decade in effect, for over a decade. As I said, millions of dollars of state and federal funding have gone into it. The municipalities, stormwater municipalities, are starting to use the system to give credit to their different efforts. The actual water quality impact or benefit, I don't know if we could say that's been seen yet. Nicole might have a comment on that, but
perhaps she could fill out a speaker card and then we could find
the ultimate
out.
You know, objective there is to increase lake clarity.
Good.
And lake clarity is measured through SECI dish monitoring, and you know, there's other factors that are affecting lake clarity as well, but in terms of tracking the reduction in fine particulate matter that's entering the lake, that they have quantitative measures of, and that they have results on.
Okay, and my last question: so we are now putting a new requirement on our permittees through this permit, which is to do some kind of a mapping of their jurisdiction into catchment basins.
Well, it's a requirement that's in the Phase 2 permit.
In the Phase 2 permit.
Yeah, and it doesn't specifically say go map your catchments. There's language that implies that's what you need to do, and so that's where I said regional board staff has to interpret the permit as well. It's never that prescriptive. And we were able to kind of put together this approach using requirements in the permit that tie together in a very nice way, includes mapping the catchments.
So we are interpreting the permit consistently with the other regional boards?
Oh, I can't speak for the other regional boards. Frankly, many of the other regional boards don't have the same number of Phase 2 communities, and they have diminished their overall efforts regarding implementation of the Phase 2 permit. They are preoccupied with other stormwater priorities. So I won't tell you that this is the approach being used elsewhere. I would tell you that this is the approach that they should be using. And that if they really want, I'm seriously though, if they want to see improvements over time, they've got to move toward this spatially explicit and quantitative approach, or else it's going to just continue circling and cycling.
But just to be clear, I think Dominic, correct me, Dominic, you said a lot of the science for this is based on the millions and hundreds of millions of dollars that have been spent in Lake Tahoe. Is that right?
I won't say hundreds of millions. I know there's multiple millions have been spent up there. The overall scheme of evaluating BMP effectiveness, loading estimations, and analysis of pollutant loading is a science that's been out there for many decades.
So we're just taking a small amount of money and leveraging a lot of other people's research.
Right.
That's true.
Okay. My last question is, so a municipality goes through their mapping, lays out their catchment basins. Looking back to our BMPs that we have in the toolbox, we will see we're not adding any new BMPs into this mix. This is simply a function of analyzing what they have on the ground in terms of catchment basins, and we would expect to see bigger water quality improvements where there's going to be significant new and redevelopment going on within a catchment area. And in some areas, there's not going to be any new or redevelopment.
Right.
So there'll be nominal improvement,
right,
which I would think would come from then those BMPs, which are kind of generic.
Programmatic, yeah.
Yeah.
So that this, you've picked up on exactly the dilemma confronting everyone at this point. The Phase 2 permit has no requirement that you go back and retrofit the existing environment and reduce loads with new structural BMPs or other efforts. It's continuing with that minimum control measure, programmatic and structural approach. But it's insisting at this point, the difference is it's insisting that you quantify the effects of those, which is different from the previous approach. We won't see necessarily any significant change in the loading under this permit term unless there's some just very low-hanging fruit that involves some quick and easy programmatic shifting of resources that can be taken in response to the prioritization method. However, in the future, we are moving toward a day when structural implementation and reduction of loads will, in a sense, be the expected outcome. And so this builds the foundation for doing that in the most intelligent way that also can be integrated with other multiple benefits so that that you aren't asking a municipality to make expenditures exclusively for water quality management of their urban runoff. You're showing them that there's this suite of benefits that are going to come from a more intelligent, spatially explicit approach to managing urban runoff. And there will be funding, state funds for that. There's an imperative at this point to plan for that with stormwater resource plans. But it can't even begin without sort of laying this kind of foundation.
Thank you, Dominic.
Okay, so at this time, I'd like to get our speakers. We have a three-minute request for Mr. Robert Kittling, and come to the podium. And I did notice with interest as you're coming to the podium that your title is almost retired. Had to bring that up. You wrote it, no?
I did indeed.
So please go ahead.
Chairman Wolf, members of the board, thank you very much. I'll make this brief. As you can, well, probably still can see on your monitors, we can't see here anymore, the City of Watsonville immediately recognized the value of the BMP RAM Teller approach. That's why we became basically the city that it was run through. And so I wholeheartedly support Dominic, Darla, and Nicole in this approach. I think it's definitely the way to go. However, I would like to maybe take us back to a 30,000-foot elevation assessment. In many respects, what we're dealing with right now is like one of those three-tier chess games where the top deck is the watershed, the middle deck are the municipalities, the counties, etc., with their jurisdictional boundaries, and the lower deck are the groundwater basins. While we can certainly look at the way in which we play the pieces on the middle deck with reference to the watershed, sub-watersheds, we have to find some way to collapse that down to a single-level chess game so that once we start looking at each individual area, let's say a sub-watershed, we can see it in the bigger context of groundwater and watershed issues. To a certain extent, we have been held hostage by the permitting structure and the jurisdictions that we have been, we basically inherited. I'm hoping that we will be able, perhaps at this regional board level or via the state board, to come up with a slightly more effective watershed metric for approaching this, because while I'm very proud with what City of Watsonville has done and what most of the municipalities have done here, you only have to step outside to see that there are bigger challenges within the watershed itself, and we as a community are part of that watershed. Thank you. In terms of, well, the groundwater that we are actually getting potable water from that is underneath your feet, this entire basin is now at sea level. So we have a significant concern right now, not only with ongoing saltwater intrusion, but increased saltwater intrusion. In terms of climate change and the potential for flooding issues, just less than a mile that way, we have the Paro River with a levee system that has just a five-year capacity on it. I've already been through two floods with this community. I've seen the damage they can hit. Then we've got the wetlands and the various issues there. A tsunami moving, or sorry, not a tsunami, but a tsunami or flood, high flow, can have incredible damage on the infrastructure from that system. So there are so many issues that affect this community that we really need to have that single-level chessboard. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your input. Agnes Topp. And it'll be 3 minutes.
Hi, I'm Agnes Topp. I'm with the City of Santa Cruz. I'm an environmental projects analyst. I work with my counterpart at the city on the stormwater program, and I've done quite a bit actually with post-construction implementation. And I've been on the stakeholder group that has worked with Dominic on developing a lot of the work that's been done in phase one of this project. I have to say it's been a really positive collaborative process up until now. We've been really pleased with how we've been able to work with the regional board on this. For us, we see the mapping effort and the loading estimate effort as actually being kind of critical. We've had role issues in communication with, you know, not only with the regional board, but also with our city councils and the public in terms of, are we making a difference? And up until now, it's been a lot of bean counting for us. Well, we're doing this, we're doing that, and we're training X number of people. But in terms of how much is that really affecting our watershed, it's really been difficult for us to really demonstrate. So we're hoping that this is going to help. The other thing that I would point out is actually the BMP tracking tool, I think, is going to be a great, tool for us. We have to keep track of maintenance of not only the public BMPs that are being put in place, but also all the private BMPs. And this is going to become a, you know, bigger task every year with each additional green infrastructure project that gets implemented. So we're hoping that that's going to also help quite a bit with just management of that element. Finally, I was at the workshop that Dominic mentioned yesterday. There was one thing that was brought up at the workshop from the Tahoe work that's been done that I thought was, you know, an interesting approach. One thing that they did mention is a lot of the monitoring that's been done so far is receiving water monitoring, And it can be a little bit depressing for most of us that are working in this field because a lot of it is either inconclusive or moves in terms of water quality improvements in the receiving water. It can be really slow to happen. And so with the BMP RAM, we're monitoring actually effectiveness of best management practices in the ground. And when something's not working, we can actually do something about it. And so that changes the sort of depressing... Oh, there I am. It sort of changes the paradigm for us from a very sort of negative sense of are we really making a difference to actually we can do something about it. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Tom Hardy, please. In 3 minutes.
Hopefully I won't take that long. Thank you. My name is Tom Hardy. I'm a civil engineer. I work for the County of Monterey Resource Management Agency. I'm also the current chair of the Monterey Regional Stormwater Management Program. So the cities on the Monterey Peninsula and Monterey County, the Phase 2 permittees, we do a lot of things together. But just wanted to support Mr. Johnston asked us to come up and say whether we are in on this, and we are absolutely also all in on this process. I just echo what Anya said, that it has been positive. The thing we met, I think, last summer to start discussing this, and the one thing we heard how much money was spent up in Lake Tahoe and the lessons that they had learned, that's things... You know, every bit of that, we can take advantage of what they've learned there and apply that here. So that's a lot of money that was invested in that effort that we don't have to reinvest and, you know, reinvent the wheel again. Just one thing I do appreciate is the opportunity by developing this. It will help us out in our stormwater management plans that we have to do for funding in the future. The Prop 1 is coming up. We're looking forward to that. And just, again, it's great to know or to be able to have a prioritized area that you can focus on instead of doing everything all over the place. It really, as Dominic said earlier, to just put more bang for the buck in a project or something. I think realistically, and we've been hearing this, Dominic has mentioned it a number of times over the last year, that at some point, retrofits will probably become part of our permit requirements. And this, by doing this now, it's setting us up for that effort in the future. So in that way, this is really valuable to us. So just wanted to confirm that if there was any question. Thank you.
Thank you. Nicole Beck.
Should jump in and just let you know, Nicole is the principal investigator, for lack of a better term, on the project, and she did the work in Tahoe, and we've been fortunate that she lives in the region and has been able to come help us here as well.
Okay, thank you. And you request 1 minute, but if you'd like 3 minutes, a little more time, certainly.
I was going to request 3 minutes, so good. So the Tahoe number is actually in the billions. In 97, the Federal Restoration Act was signed, and I got out of grad school in 2001. I have an aquatic chemistry degree and did a lot of work in Tahoe initially, and in 2007, they came out with what they did with the first $1.1 billion, and it was a lot of the box checking. We've treated this many miles of road. We have done these many projects, but they couldn't say anything about the water quality benefits. So that has inspired a lot of the work that my group has done. We've worked with a couple of other consultant firms in Tahoe Basin on really trying to be able to prioritize and then quantify the effectiveness of actions. The Tahoe program is not perfect, and so this is really a great opportunity. And yesterday I thought it was really positive to hear our partners talk about Tahoe, and then I think we're even doing it better. We've taken a lot of the lessons learned. We've made it simpler and more focused. Our entire approach is really making it everything scientifically defensible, but yet as simple as possible. And you can see from the red, yellow, and green maps, I mean, that's talking about pollutant fate and transport, urban hydrology, et cetera. But now we can communicate a lot better. So prioritizing and the prioritization is really important, and then being able that effectiveness component. And it's all done on a common unit. So the benefit to all of you is that more of the municipalities that use it, or the benefit to Dominic, is that now you can start comparing across the region, across the state. And I really think this approach is applicable to, I mean, nationwide, any municipality. And the reason that the EPA and Region 2 board had the workshop yesterday is because they realized some of the things they've been doing with their permits aren't working, and they're reaching out to their Bay Area permittees and trying to develop a collaborative approach. And the last thing I'll say is that, I commend the board and Dominic and this group for, I think we are on the cutting edge. And all of the tools we have Silicon Valley right over the hill. So they're web-based software platforms, and the managers will be able to sit down and use these on their desktop. So it makes it's a data management system intent is to be a 20-year, 30-year program and tool. Thank you.
Well, thank you, yeah. And appreciate and thanks for being here today and hearing from your experience at Tahoe. So maybe you mentioned it, but how many years was that project ongoing at Tahoe? I heard the money part.
The money, right. So in 2008, they started building what they're calling a crediting program. And again, people that were there yesterday heard about the crediting program. In my opinion, it might be a little more complicated than necessary. There has been a lot of iterative process. They right now have just released the final tools and are having municipalities register catchment and play this game towards, they have a series of milestones associated with reducing urban loading to the lake. But through the process, I mean, the priority source of pollutants, impairing the clarity, is roadways. They truck in 12,000 metric tons of abrasives in the winter, and when we started working up there, you could take a 5-gallon bucket down a road and pick up black baking powder. So it didn't take PhDs to say this is your source of that fine sediment that's impairing your lake, and that's not there anymore. So even though they haven't been the program and all the tools haven't, I mean, they're being used, but they haven't been formally adopted into the program until literally 3 weeks ago. There is a significant behavior change and an understanding of where to spend their resources. There was a lot of money spent on capital improvement projects. They could get millions of dollars, check the box, build something. There was no maintenance, and there was no money for now the vacuum-assisted sweepers that they use up there and the O&M dollars going into their road maintenance and operation group. So it's really, it's made a difference, and again, the lake's going to take a while. It's got a 600-year residence time, right? So if we're going to measure success on how far they can lower a dinner plate into the lake, it's going to take a little bit of time, but all the theory and our hypothesis of that entire TMDL is going in the right direction.
Thank you very much. yes,
questions? I'm just curious. This is really a question for either of you. I'm sure you can answer it. So what defines a catch basin?
Water flow.
water
drains
down.
You could
have water flow over a much bigger area than what we saw put up for Watsonville.
Yeah, so you have a big one, and then we turned it into smaller pieces of the puzzle so that they can manage them on smaller units.
And so what are the criteria then to break down the bigger end of the smaller units?
So we can get into details, but basically they overlay topography, how the landscape is, and then any existing mapping they have with their stormwater infrastructure that we know is changing how water will move through the system. And based on those, they make these delineations. It's guidance for the municipalities to do this. We're not doing it in a box. We help them make these decisions. Might be a better question for some of them, but they can go out and check whether or not the crown of a road is dividing the way water moves through a system, et cetera. But the idea is now we have a series of discrete drainage units that makes it much easier for them to manage.
So theoretically, then, at the bottom of the basin, they might have a couple of points where water could actually be captured.
I went with the Watsonville staff last week, and we went to a catchment over here, and there's an aging basin that was put in when the development was made, and we talked about opportunities to improve its, you know, maintain it so it's working it the way it was designed, and or maybe expanding it to have it serve multiple beneficial uses. So, yeah, that's common.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Can I introduce a terminology issue? And the term catch basin is used in civil engineering to describe small kind of physical devices, in a sense, that are in the flow path that allow stuff to fall out of suspension, and they can be cleaned out, and they might occur with each drop inlet on a street for a storm drain system. So those are catch basins. That's the way that term is typically used. And then we're using a term catchment, which is really means small watershed. So the catchments or urban watersheds are the bigger landscape feature or units that we're talking about.
So that's not a catch 22.
No catch 22 there, no.
We'll make sure to exclude that number. I will allow, now that I get to stand here without a beeper, the competitive funding advantage that this region will have with Prop 1, I mean, this is using those maps to demonstrate to a funder why we need money to do improvements in these particular areas, that it's a common unit, that they can understand what the value is for. All of those proposals and grants have how are you going to quantify your benefit and what are you going to use, and we've started to use these tools for other types of funding, and it's really pretty easy to say we use this web-based tool, there's a user guidance, there's a technical document, it's all been vetted, so it's a huge advantage to bring money here to actually implement these improvements.
Thank you very much. And last we have Darla Inglis, and then it'll be your opportunities to ask further questions.
While Darla's coming up, I want to say it clearly this topic is of great interest to the board, so I would ask Dominic in the future when, as this progresses and he has some examples or future success stories, that he come back to the board and sort of give you an update of how this is rolling out.
Hello, everyone. Well, you heard a lot of the background on the why of the project and the way the program is changing. You brought me on board several years ago to help with the low-impact development program and further that, especially the post-construction requirements. And I think we've done a pretty good job along that route, and I think some of that work will continue. However, I do strongly support this work. I put on my municipal hat from being a program manager for 10 years in Seattle, and it is just absolutely fundamental to be able to understand where your risks are and where your opportunities are to focus those resources. I couldn't go to a city council. I couldn't go to the mayor's office. I couldn't negotiate with Department of Ecology, which was the equivalent of this water board, without that type of information. And it seems somewhat obvious or straightforward to do something like that, but it hasn't been done, especially among phase two communities. So this is really not only keeping up on where stormwater is going, but keeping the Central Coast region on the cutting edge of that evolution of stormwater. So I very strongly support this work.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Inglis. It's always great to see you. We don't have many opportunities, as many as I'd like anyway, to hear some of the details of the progress that we do hear about. So I'm glad you made the trip today, because I know you're actually based down in San Luis County still, right? Okay. So I think, you know, what I'm most interested in is, and we've had conversations along those lines, about working in communities and creating this this space in which people can talk about the problems that they're encountering or anticipating or fear, which may not even ever come to be, but many times those fears prevent people from engaging in authentic dialogue, and especially when there's regulation attached to it. So I just was hoping to hear from your perspective, what are the how this process might serve as a model for others. Is that a dimension of the work that you've done? I know coming from with your background and coming into this program, one of the reasons that we thought you would be the perfect person to lead this effort is because you had seen it work in other places. So how do you think this process now is going to forward or advance this type of collaborative, coordinated, technical support, integrated efficiencies gained, all of those things? Are we doing something to show what that model looks like to others in the state and, for that matter, in the country?
I don't know if we've shared the examples here to date, but the post-construction requirements, the development of those, I was heavily involved in that. Obviously, Dominic was heavily involved in that, as were the municipalities. And it's very interesting to me to see that in not all cases, I'm working with a lot of the phase two statewide through some other efforts, that they don't have that collaborative effort. And for whatever reasons, and it was mentioned yesterday as well, for whatever reason, sometimes the municipalities don't just call up their stormwater person for maybe some of that fear. So I think between the post-construction requirements development, the low impact development initiative, and the technical resources that are there, and now this potential work, we three times now have a model where we're working all together, the regulator, the municipality, and now this other entity. Sometimes I see myself as a bit of a facilitator, sometimes, you know, bringing in emerging work, but that combination seems to be working very well from my perspective.
Well, I hope that the work is what it is, and there's only so many hours every day, but I would really urge our staff and in your capacity in leading the Low Impact Development Institute, that we really look ahead and think about how can we promote this process more comprehensively. And again, we're building on Tahoe's experience. I think we have something also that we can offer. I know this board has put considerable, we have confidence in the potential for LID, the LID Institute in leading